G.K. Chesterton, and as you can see from the picture there, he looks like boatloads of fun, doesn't he? Actually, he really is boatloads of fun. And in fact, I love this picture because I can't help but believe that he is just hamming it up for the camera. He is a delightful character. So G.K. Chesterton, and you know, this is a much longer handout than I usually give. In my talk tonight, I'll just be focusing on the first page front and back as I usually do. The third page is assorted further quotes of Chesterton for you to read at your own leisure. Chesterton is one of the great writers of the Christian tradition. Much of what he writes is really worth reading and thinking about and laughing at too. He's a great humorist. So some of the quotes on there are for humor's sake alone. But we'll be focusing on the first two pages of this handout in my talk. But before I get to the verses, let me just introduce him quickly. This guy is very special to me. He is one of my very favorite writers. He was a writer by trade, and when it comes to nonfiction writing, he has affected my life more deeply than probably anyone else out there. I first read his book, Orthodoxy, when I was serving in Angola on my missionary work, and it so struck me that I turned right around and read it a second time through right then and there. And it has really played a lot into my own thought and my own writing as well. So shortly, one of my new novels is going to come out, hopefully within just a few weeks or maybe a month. But if you know Chesterton well, and you're reading my book, you'll definitely find certain passages where you'll be able to say, oh, that's Chesterton coming through. So he has certainly touched my life. In fact, if I were to, that old question, if you were to pick three books to take with you to a desert island other than the Bible, which would you choose? Orthodoxy would be one of my three. The other two we've already covered in this course, The Imitation of Christ and Revelations of Divine Love. But Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton would definitely be my third. And he was deeply, deeply influential to a number of people. C.S. Lewis, Mahatma Gandhi actually was deeply influenced by Chesterton. And the modern author, Philip Yancey, also gives a lot of credit to Chesterton. Let's look at these verses here as the theme of our study. Romans chapter 1, verse 20, this is the Apostle Paul writing to the church in Rome, and he's speaking about the Gentiles and how they too, even though they did not receive the covenant, still are under responsibility for the knowledge of God that they could have received through the natural world. Romans 1:20, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. This is a theme that Chesterton picks up on a lot. What we are going to look at him mostly in this study is as an apologist, as a defender of the Christian faith. And the way he went about it was to take all of life, all of the universe as we know it, and say, which philosophy makes the best sense? Which one fits the best? And he's going to say that modern philosophy really fails at a fundamental level, and that Christianity fits the best with what we can simply see, with what we feel in our hearts that life is like. So let's look now at the next verse. This is Matthew 18, verses 2 and 3. Jesus called a little child and had him stand among them. And he said, I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Of course, there are many interpretations as to what it means to become childlike in the way that Jesus intended it here. I think he's probably, in this context, speaking about a quality of faith and a quality of humility. But Chesterton takes childlikeness to whole new levels. He is a jokester for his whole life, and he really brings out the joyful side of the Christian message. Everything he did was for the sheer pleasure of it. Even in just the way he went around. He would go around dressed in these overcoats and funny hats, and he would always have a cigar, and he would have a sword stick in his hand, a cane from a sword. I have a smaller example here. This is from Tanzania. You can see there's a sword hidden inside of it. Chesterton would have one of these as a cane and just walk around the streets with it for the sheer fun of it, I think. This is the sort of guy he was. And I think it was important that he was this kind of character because he was facing a culture and a philosophy that was very weary of life, really, was very suspicious of the goodness of the world and the existence of God, and really had not much else to offer the world than skepticism. And a lot of people were buying into it. And they looked at Christianity as something old and boring. We've tried that. It doesn't work. It doesn't even inspire us anymore. This is what Britain and Europe was feeling about 100 years ago. And for us here in America, America has always had a slightly more religious, fiercely religious twinge to it. Only now are we starting to get to the same sort of point that G.K. Chesterton faced in Europe 100 years ago, with this sort of gloomy skepticism. And Chesterton, in his writing, emphasizes wonder and joy and just the wild delight of the gospel. And I think in that sense, he is just as important for our own times as he was for his time. So let's take a look at Chesterton's life here. I have the first note there beside his picture. Gilbert Keith Chesterton was an English journalist and author whose work touched on the fields of theology, fiction, apologetics, philosophy, biography, poetry, politics, culture, current affairs, art, and literature, just to name a few. He is remembered today for his aphoristic quotes and his way of melding humor with profound Christian reflection. Let me back up and highlight some of those long list of things that I mentioned before, because he really did have a vast influence. In theology, he's not really known as a theologian, because he didn't really add new insights to the Christian theological enterprise. But what he did was he added a new perspective. He added a new viewpoint from which to see the gospel message. This viewpoint of paradox and of wonder and of childlikeness that, quite frankly, most of the European theologians sitting over there in their dusty universities with their books had lost. And so he did have a profound impact on theology. Fiction. He was a great writer of fiction, both novels, short stories. He even did a few plays. Apologetics. That's, as I said, that's mainly the light in which we're looking at him tonight. Apologetics is the defense of the Christian faith. I know it makes it sound like you're offering apologies for something, but it actually goes back to the Latin. Apologia meant defense. So these are the people who take on the skeptical philosophies, show why those philosophies fail, and why Christianity simply makes better sense of the evidence. Philosophy. He wasn't known again as a philosopher, but he did have an impact there, mostly as a critic of modern philosophy. Biography. He dabbled in biography and history. Some of his more famous works are biographies of Francis of Assisi and Thomas Aquinas, two fellows that we've talked about during this series. Poetry. He published books of poetry. One of his most famous was The Ballad of the White Horse, which was an epic poem about the days of Alfred the Great and the barbarian invasions. Politics. He was deeply involved in the politics of his time. He was a voice for the independence of Ireland back when Britain still ruled all of Ireland and the Irish were trying to fight against that. But here's Chesterton as an Englishman, as a renowned journalist, saying, no, the Irish ought to have home rule. So he stood up for them. He stood up for the poor working class as well. Had a great impact there. In culture, he had a vast influence because he had millions of readers. Millions of readers who, most of them were probably buying into this new skeptical philosophy, this new way of thinking about culture. And he had a voice unlike most Christians of his day did, because people would read him just because he was such a brilliant and witty writer. So again, a tremendous influence there. Current affairs, the same influence. Art, he actually began his study as an artist. In fact, the little sketch down below, which is not too, I don't know how to put it. It's not the most generous portrayal of G.K. Chesterton, but it's actually it's a picture he drew himself, of himself. So there he is with his girth and his double chin. He didn't seem to have any problem with it. And literature. Now, this is something that even Chesterton fans in the Christian church don't know much about. G.K. Chesterton had a profound impact in literature, and the greatest impact he had was actually that he was the one who turned Charles Dickens into a classic author. That might sound strange. Charles Dickens is known by everyone as an author of classic novels. But Charles Dickens back in the 1800s was wildly popular. He was like a John Grisham or a Stephen King. Everyone bought his novels and loved them. But no one until G.K. Chesterton came along said, look, this guy's literary talents are at another level, and we need to continue to look at and study his work. So he brought Dickens back from a few decades of obscurity and made him relevant again. But mostly, so that's just a quick taste of the breadth of his impact.
How about we should do a series on him?
Yes, actually, sometimes you'll still find, especially the Catholic Channel, they'll do presentations on G.K. Chesterton.
That's quite good.
Yep. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
He's a genius.
I think he is a genius.
Looks like a genius to me.
Let's look at the second note on Chesterton's little box there. Chesterton grew up in a nominally Christian family. After being driven to near-suicidal depression by nihilistic philosophy while at art school, he slowly returned to the faith. Over the course of several decades, he moved from a vague Christian faith to high church Anglicanism, and then finally to Roman Catholicism. He was born, actually, in a family that baptized him in the Anglican Church, but that wasn't uncommon. Pretty much everyone in England did that, even if they didn't consider themselves churchgoers. So he was baptized there. His parents were probably Unitarians, if nothing else. But he really wasn't raised with much of an idea of Christian faith. And so he wandered away, and when he enrolled in art school as a young man, he was always brilliant, so he started studying philosophy. And the philosophy of the time, much of it was coming out of Germany with Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, and it was just tremendously depressing philosophy about God being dead and life as a meaningless thing. This is what we call nihilism. And nihilism basically is a system of belief which says nothing matters. Nothing has any meaning. We're just animals walking around on a planet that happens to be here by chance. Well, as you can tell, this is pretty gloomy stuff, and it got to Chesterton, and he nearly ended his own life. But he was brought back by a number of influences. Not all of them were necessarily Christians. He was brought back by great poetry. Not enough people read great poetry anymore. But Chesterton was brought back by poets like Robert Browning, Walt Whitman, who wrote about the glory and the mystery of nature. This is just a taste of one of Walt Whitman's poems. He says, this is from the Song of Myself. I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of stars, and the narrowest hinge in my hand puts to scorn all machinery, and the cow crunching with depressed head surpasses any statue, and a mouse is miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels. Just this beautiful idea of the majesty and wonder of nature, that there's got to be something more to it than just this crude matter. And this brought Chesterton back around. Poetry like that the adventure novels of Robert Louis Stevenson, Kidnapped, Treasure Island. These are things that brought him back to faith. And then he met a woman. He met a young lady named Frances. There's a picture of her with Chesterton on the back page there. And they ended up getting married. She was always a very passionate believer, an Anglican. And he first met her at debate clubs where he would hear her standing up for the faith. And he had never really heard someone do this in quite the same way before. And they really had a tremendous relationship through the years. She put up with a lot of his eccentricities very well. There are old folk tales about him being sort of this absent-minded genius. He would be away somewhere and... let me see, I have an example here. He says, "It is reported that on several occasions he sent a telegram to his wife Frances from some distant and incorrect location, writing such things as, 'I'm at Market Harborough, where ought I to be?' To which she would reply, 'Home.'" So they got along quite well together, and she really was an inspiration to his faith. And he started moving in that direction. He didn't tie himself down to any one particular church for a long while, but he got into the writing business. He went down to Fleet Street, the journalistic hub of London, and he got a job as a newspaper columnist. And this is what he did for the next 30 to 40 years. He wrote daily newspaper columns that were read all over Britain, many other parts of the world as well. And then he started writing books. First he wrote a book called Heretics, about modern philosophy and how he thought they were wrong. But he didn't really put out his own ideas in that book. He waited a couple more years and then wrote the classic book that I love, Orthodoxy. And it's an exposition of the Christian faith, but it's like none you've ever read before. It has all kinds of fairy tales and adventures and all other things woven into it. It's just tremendous. And eventually he did. He loved the mystery. He loved the wonder of the sort of high church liturgical worship, which brought him to Anglicanism and then eventually to Roman Catholicism. Let me read that third quote, that third note there. This just lists some of his books. His best known works today are Orthodoxy, Apologetics, The Man Who Was Thursday, which is a fiction novel, The Father Brown Stories. If anyone who's not a Christian knows of Chesterton nowadays, it's often through Father Brown. He's a very popular character in detective fiction for many years. St. Francis of Assisi, which was biography, and The Everlasting Man. Those are just a few. He wrote shelves and shelves of books in addition to his newspaper columns. But let's look now at the themes of his work. As a newspaper columnist, as a writer and author, I'm going to spend more time on his thought than on his life, like I have in some other studies in this course. So let's take a look at the themes of Chesterton's work. The first one there says, the insufficiency of modern philosophies. Atheistic and agnostic ideas, which leave no room for the spiritual dimension of life, are manifestly unable to match our common sense understanding of the way things are. They also often suffer from an overblown sense of certainty and a tragic arrogance against earlier periods of history. This is something that is, as I say, as relevant today as it was 100 years ago. If any of you keep track of sort of the publishing world and nonfiction books that are hitting it big, you know that in the past 5 years or so, there have been a collection of books put out by a movement that calls themselves the New Atheists. And they've been writing just vicious attacks against religion, and most specifically against Christian belief. Richard Dawkins wrote The God Delusion. Sam Harris wrote a couple, Letter to a Christian Nation. There are other names out there. Daniel Dennett is a philosopher who's written some of these books. But these guys fit Chesterton's response as well now as he did 100 years ago. They just seem to miss a lot of the big picture. In arguing against Christianity, you just come away with this feeling that they have their eyes closed to what a lot of us understand as some of the biggest realities of life. And in fact, they often show themselves to be rather poorly educated on the history of the Christian tradition and some of the great arguments for the faith that come out of that tradition. Flip over to the back page. We're going to look at the first few quotes here. These are all from Orthodoxy. Under Critique of Modern Philosophies, Chesterton says, "As an explanation of the world, materialism..." I should explain. By materialism, he doesn't mean consumerism, the sort of buy-everything philosophy that we sometimes talk about as materialistic. When he talks about materialism, he's talking about a philosophy that says the only thing that exists in the universe is material, matter. That's what materialism is. So he says, "As an explanation of the world, materialism has a sort of insane simplicity. We have at once the sense of it covering everything and the sense of it leaving everything out." So as I just said, you come away with this sense that, well, there's no room for wonder, for mystery, for spirit in this explanation of the universe. And most of us would say, that's an awfully big part of the way we perceive the world. The next quote says, "The materialist is sure that history has been simply and solely a chain of causation, just as the madman mentioned before is quite sure that he is simply and solely a chicken. Materialists and madmen never have doubts. Spiritual doctrines do not actually limit the mind, as do materialistic denials." Here he's responding to materialist philosophers, atheists, who say, look, in rejecting Christianity, we are throwing off these centuries of thought that have limited our perspective. Now that we know the truth, we can broaden our minds. And Chesterton says, no, not really. And in fact, if you even read the New Atheist book today, they come across with just this passionate sense that of course they are right, and everybody else in the world who doesn't agree with them has to be stupid, because of course they're right. They have no doubts whatsoever. And I always find it tremendously refreshing when atheists come across with some intellectual humility. There are a few of them out there who do. But Chesterton says, no, look, you're actually limiting your perspective. So, see, we as Christians, we can believe in the possibility of miracles. Materialists can't. It's just ruled out at the beginning. They look at the evidence for the resurrection. Most Christians would say, there's actually pretty good historical evidence that this thing actually happened. And the materialists have to say, no, it couldn't happen. It couldn't happen because things like that don't happen. So, in a sense, Chesterton's right. They're actually limiting their perspective. In Orthodoxy, Chesterton phrases this in his much more whimsical way and talks about how we can even believe in fairies if we want. You know, why couldn't God have made fairies or hobbits or something like that? Materialists can't believe in those things. The third quote, "Now it is the charge against the main deductions of the materialist that, right or wrong, they gradually destroy his humanity. I do not mean only kindness. I mean hope, courage, poetry, initiative, all that is human." And this is one of the tragic downfalls of atheist philosophy, is that it really doesn't leave a solid basis for ethics, for morals, for the things that most of us humans believe are important. I mean, if it really isn't true, none of it, God, Jesus, that whole thing, why on earth do we need to be bound down by any rules? If we're just animals, let's just do whatever we want to do. Well, most of us, most of the world would say, hold on, we don't want to go that far. The trouble is, once you kick God out of the picture, you don't have much choice. You don't have any solid grounding left to hold on to those things that most define us as human beings. Flip back to the front again for just a moment. We're going to look at the bottom two themes I've listed here. The second one says, Christianity simply makes sense. In contrast to modern philosophies, faith makes sense of our basic perceptions of the world, it respects human value and encourages virtue, and it honors the worth of our traditions. And then the third theme is wonder and joy. The fundamental attitude of the human towards God, the universe, and life in general ought to be a childlike sense of wonder and of awestruck gratitude. And I really agree with him in those things. It's interesting to note that as an apologist, Chesterton goes around it differently than some do. Some actually take on each of the arguments from science, from history, and so on, from philosophy, that atheists throw at, and rebut each one. And we've seen philosophers like that. Thomas Aquinas was one. And we need people like that. But we also need people like Chesterton, who are able to sort of step back and say, let's see the big picture. And when you look at the big picture, just the underlying premises of the atheistic philosophy looks like it's full of holes. It just doesn't fit what we know of the world. Look at the quotes under Christian faith. This first one is one of my favorite quotes of Chesterton, and one that you might hear most often from him. And before I read it, let me explain the context. Chesterton is replying to atheist philosophers who say, look, you look at the world, and everything just seems to run like clockwork. Nothing ever changes. There's very little artistry in any of it. It seems like a machine. Sun comes up, sun goes down. Daisies grow, daisies die. Happens every year, just the same. Why do you need God behind that? It's just all doing it by itself. Here's what Chesterton says in response. Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, do it again. And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. That's actually true. I'm experiencing that now. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exult in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun, and every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy, for we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. Isn't that a beautiful idea and a beautiful expression? You can see the winsomeness of this man and his writing. I think it gives us a very true picture of God. You know, often we picture God as sort of distant and removed. Yeah, we know he loves us, but I think sometimes, at least in my own experience, I often don't meditate on the joy of the Lord and think about the delight that he gets in all of his creation, including each one of us. Just this overflow of joy in the things that he has made. What a refreshing perspective on the God that we serve. Let's look at the next quote here. These so far that we've read are all from Orthodoxy. He says, man is more like himself, man is more manlike, when joy is the fundamental thing in him, and grief is superficial. Melancholy should be an innocent interlude, a tender and fugitive frame of mind. Praise should be the permanent pulsation of the soul. I love that turn of phrase right there. Praise should be the permanent pulsation of the soul. Pessimism is at best an emotional half-holiday. Joy is the uproarious laughter by which all things live. Christianity satisfies suddenly and perfectly man's ancestral instinct for being the right way up. Satisfies it supremely in this, that by its creed, joy becomes something gigantic and sadness something special and small. And I think this is true. This is Chesterton looking at the big picture again. So when we look at human existence, and when we step back and reflect on our lives as we perceive them, most of us agree that when we look at tragedy in the world, when we look at death when we look at sorrow, that there's something in our hearts that tells us this is not how it was supposed to be. And that's what Chesterton is saying here, that instinct in the center of the human soul is onto something. That is not the way it's supposed to be. We were made for joy in the presence of God. The next quote down talks about why he believes in Christianity. And it talks about it with reference to the sun. He says, "The one created thing which we cannot look at is the one thing in the light of which we look at everything. Like the sun at noonday, mysticism, that is, Christian spirituality, explains everything else by the blaze of its own victorious invincibility." And C.S. Lewis picked up this argument as well in his writing. He said, you know, one of the fundamental reasons why I'm a Christian is because when I look at the world in the light of Christian faith, it actually makes sense. In a way that nothing else makes sense. So Chesterton says, like the sun, sometimes we can't look straight at it. Sometimes we can't look at the mystery of God and understand everything about how it works. But in light of that mystery, we can see that everything else in life is illuminated. We can understand history and the world for what it was meant to be. I think this is true. It answers the question, you know, why do we see death as something strange and foreign? Christianity answers that. Why can't humans be good? Why can't humans even live up to their own standards? Most philosophies don't have a great answer to that question, but Christianity does. It's not the nicest answer that we could imagine, but it answers that question, and it answers it in a satisfying way. We are fallen. Simple questions like, why is the world beautiful? If everything arose simply by chance, why do we poor creatures find such beauty and mystery and majesty in the world around us? That says to me, well, maybe it's not by chance. And Christianity illuminates questions like that. Let's look at the next quote there. He says, "The more I considered Christianity, the more I found that while it had established a rule and order, the chief aim of that order was to give room for good things to run wild." And so this is against the idea that certain atheist philosophers of his day had, that, you know, Christianity is just this old stodgy thing. It has limited us with its rules, with its morals, and the quicker we cast it off, the better off we'll be. Well, I think most of us, if we step back and look at life, we'll say, you know what? Those people whom we know who have cast off the rules and the morals in order to live a liberated life have often ended up with the most heartbreak and the most sorrow. The truth is, we as human beings need some of those boundaries and guardrails in our lives. And so I think he's exactly right. This is what Christianity does. It's not a limiting factor in its rules and its morals. It's a door to liberation. They're the guardrails on our road up to the mountaintop to give room for good things to run wild. Just a couple other quick ones. I had always felt life first as a story, and if there is a story, there's a storyteller. This is fundamental Chesterton. If you pick up Orthodoxy and try to read it, just a warning, it takes a little bit to get into him. He's kind of a scattered writer who'll throw these huge sentences around at you. But if you can get through the first few pages, you'll get a sense of his rhythm. But this is often what he's about. He talks about, just in his own life, this underlying sense that there's meaning in life, that his life is a story, that it's pointed somewhere, that he has this adventure he's on. And because of this idea of meaning, he knew that someone had to be behind it. The final quote speaks again to some of his atheist opponents. And they were saying at the time, Christians back then, you know, they didn't know what we know now. They could believe it then. We can't believe it now. We tried all this back in the Dark Ages, and look, it just didn't work. Let's leave Christianity behind. Chesterton says, The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried. And again, I think that's very true in a large part. We are out of time, but I've given you a whole list of other Chesterton quotes to whet your appetite. Some are very thoughtful and profound. Some are just plain funny, just to give you a taste of his temperament. But I would encourage you to read them. I have plenty of his books of my own. I'd be happy to loan some of them out. But I want to just leave you with this sense of his, that as Christians we ought to be able to see the world through the lens of the joy of the Lord. Not just the joy that he gives, but the joy that God in himself has. So to grab all of life, even the simple things, with awe and with gratitude. I'm going to end by reading a poem. This is a poem that I wrote shortly after reading Orthodoxy for the first time. And it's not nearly as good as Chesterton writes, but since it's one of my own, I thought I'd share it with my church family. It's called Come and See. Come and ride the restless wave with me. Leave behind the petty worries of the day. Open your eyes to a world wild and alive, an ancient realm forever young, possessed of the breathtaking fervor of endless possibility. Come and dance upon the mountains, drink the wild and reckless tide of life. There is music of an ever-circling round that overflows all boundaries of reason and belief in its race to reach delight. Traces of Eden surround us still, in the bright sun that casts a million sparkling diamonds onto the endless wave, in the vibrant green of springtime, responding to gentle rains of grace, in the radiant smile of a little child as he raises his wondering eyes for one glimpse of the heavens. Come with me and meet the Maker here. Come with me and taste the life he gives. This world shouts his praise, and it shouts for you to hear. O kindred friend, join your heart in the laughter of the dawn, the exultant chorus of the boundless sea. Drink deep from the fountain of heaven's joy. It flows for you. Oh, come and see. Let's close with a word of prayer. Gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for this world that you've made. We thank you that you are so evident in it, and in the way that you have made us to long for you and to desire that life of meaning. So Father, I pray that each one of us this week would be able to give ourselves to you, to give ourselves to the adventure and delight of being one of your creations. And Lord, may we share in just a taste of your joy this week. We ask this in the name of your Son. Amen. Thank you for coming. Go in peace.